Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today in Research on Religion, we're doing something a little different on the show. First, regular listeners know that beyond scholars, we like to feature, on occasion, practitioners, those folks who work in the trenches of the religious sector of our economy, so to speak. This includes clergy, lawyers, advocates, and other folks. So that's what we're doing today. That's not really that new. Second, we are also doing an in-person interview rather than a phone interview, so hopefully our sound quality will be a little bit better. I finally geared up to the point where I can do such in-person discussions much easier, though most of our episodes will still involve phone interviews since I don't have the budget to fly all over the world. My travels today just take me on a downhill roll to my hometown of Duval, Washington. And again, we've done in-person interviews in the past, so that's not really new. What is really new here is the third neat feature of today's episode. We are actually recording this in a local small-town coffee house, which might make this the first on-location interview of the podcast. So we'd like to thank the good folks at Match Coffee and Wine in Duval, Washington, for letting us use their space. If my recorder does pick up some of the background ambient noise of the coffee house, like the truck that just rolled by, you can just imagine that you're sipping a cup of cappuccino along with us, enjoying our conversation. And so that brings me to the topic of today's interview. Sociologists of religion are often interested in the phenomena of church growth. Why do some churches grow big, gaining lots of adherents, whereas others seem to stagnate or decline? Part and parcel of this topic is we are also interested in where new churches come from. One of the hallmarks of the American religious landscape is its constant innovation and denominational churning. Now, for the most part, us scholars only observe the churches that have been around for a while. It's actually pretty difficult to find a church that is just being created in order to see what is going on in those initial weeks or months. And when we additionally or finally get around to finding a church that just started off, it's oftentimes months or years after the fact, making a lot of the historical memory fade from the people who are involved in this. So I have to admit that I'm pretty excited about engaging this. This might actually be a research project for me. And so one of the added benefits of this show is that you get to see what scholars do when they actually investigate topics like this. And so the question I'll be asking today, or several of the questions, is what does it take to get a church off the ground? What particular challenges do such startup churches face? Well, it just so happens that a new church is being formed in the city of Duval, Washington, around where I live, and I thought I'd jump at the opportunity to interview the lead pastor on that endeavor to see what challenges face a brand new church. And by brand new, we're talking about a church that is roughly 10 days old at the time of this recording, and which did not even have a name a week ago. So we're literally watching the breaking of ground on this new organization. The pastor of that church, Matt Boswell, joins me today to talk about his and his staff's first week of setting up a new church. Matt, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hey, thanks, Tony. It's good to be with you, man.
I want to specifically focus on what it takes to build a new church in the first week of its existence. And now, part of that story might actually include knowing what motivated the church to start up in the first place, but I don't really want to dwell on that today because that really is a separate story that is worth a podcast unto itself. Suffice it to say that this new congregation is the result of a schism in a pre-existing congregation, something that, again, is rather common in the American religious experience. My focus today, though, is what happens in the first week of when you set up a church? What does it actually take on a day-to-day basis here? And again, we get to see this at the ground level, which is very exciting as a scholar. And then, so to that extent, I'm going to ask Matt to give us a little bit of demographic background of the area where this is all happening so that our listeners can get a fuller picture of what the town of Duval, Washington is all about.
Yeah, Duval's kind of an interesting place, mostly because it has shifted a lot demographically in the last two decades, right? So, you know, and it's been here for a long time, but you go back to the original inception of Duval, very much a farming community, very blue-collar that way, that kind of thing. But then in the last 20 years, as Microsoft, you know, was headquartered in Redmond, Duval became, in a lot of ways, kind of a bedroom community for the tech industry. And a lot of people that were in the white-collar world began to move to Duval to say, like, hey, it's a little bit less expensive to live there. You get the small-town experience, but you're, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes from work, right? So there was this whole fundamental shift that took place. And so for churches in this community, even that was an interesting design. You had the ones that were here for a long time, and they were very much ministering to and serving the long-term, you know, kind of meat and potatoes of Duval. But then in these last two decades, they have shifted, right, to kind of match a lot of the incoming, you know, people that have moved into town over the years and stuff. And so, you know, we kind of call it old Duval and new Duval in that sense, because it really is two different populaces that are living together in one community.
And it still is a pretty small town population-wise. I think the town itself has about 6,000 people. And then when you start talking about the surrounding community in the rural area, a lot of small extra bedroom communities, you're probably talking about 10 to 12,000, I would guess.
Yeah, right? I think that'd be my estimate too.
Yeah. Okay, so we're forming a church in here. And first of all, give us a real brief background about yourself, just so we know that you're not just some guy who walked off the street who used to be a plumber or a Microsoft techie and then decided to set up a church. Do you have some theological background or anything?
Yeah, I do actually. So I've been in the pastoral gig for about 20 years now. And so I have a bachelor's from Prairie Bible College in Canada and a master's at Trinity Seminary. And so that's kind of the academic background. As far as the pastoral experience, most of my pastoral life was over in Spokane, Washington. So did an internship there, pastored in three different churches over there that were all affiliated. It wasn't a denominational affiliation. It was more of a, hey man, we have the same beliefs and values and heart, that kind of thing. And so that kind of network I was always in Spokane until early 2008 when I came over here to Duval.
That's kind of interesting. You talk about that in Spokane, the networking of, I guess, like-minded churches. It's not a denomination. That's something that I think we're going to get into in a little bit, because it seems to be more of a wave of the future where churches are going, and might be a way of understanding how churches can grow in many cases. For those of us who study the sociology of religion, particularly the economics of religion, we emphasize a lot of things about the competition or religious competition. But one of the interesting things I think a lot of people forget about that is they see competition as a negative sum game rather than a positive sum game, where you have different denominations. And yes, you're trying to lure members to your church as compared to another church, but really there's a synergistic dynamism that goes on, that your church can help my church because, oh, you did an interesting program and you're kind of thinking like us, and can we borrow that program? Is that some of the stuff that
went on? Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things where I think, you know, I'll just be more on the record, quote, off the record with it, but I think pastors deep down in their heart, they know that there is that dynamic, even though it may not sound popular in the mainstream to say there is some level of friendly competition, so to speak. But I do believe what that causes is either one of two things. It either has some guys in ministry that then say, well, you know, I'm either too tired to compete, or I'm not sure I have the gifting or the skill set, and they kind of just isolate a little bit. But I think it causes other guys to go, no, I want to do better. You know what I mean? And I think in that sense, when it comes to advancing, you know, the cause of Christ and the kingdom of Christ, it brings out a lot better things and worse things. And I think that's, you know, in a lot of ways, I look around and I go, I think the way you see the church in the 21st century in the United States and the innovations that it's made is because there is this undertow in it that says, hey man, you know, like that guy did that was really cool. Can I do something like that or even better?
Right.
Can we communicate this message in a better context? Right. The message is enduring, but the context, or we call it contextualization, right? We want to figure out how do we contextualize for, like in our case, okay, we're in the Northwest. We're in one of the more liberal places in the United States. How do we contextualize the gospel? How do we contextualize the message of the church in that environment? And we look around and go, well, that guy did it that way, and that was pretty cool. We can capitalize on that, tweak it a little bit, make it more effective. And that's certainly going to be different than some guy down in the South. Like, you know, personally, me as a pastor, they would run me out of town if I was down in the South. You know what I mean? But a guy in the South coming up here would equally get run out of town because of the way we contextualize. So even some of this, you know, quote, competition or friendly learning and trying to refine is different from subculture to subculture in the United States even.
Right.
So, you know, that makes it even a little bit more, I don't know, like micro refining. You know, it's just not a macro issue.
Yeah.
So,
And that's, I think, very interesting and relevant for today's discussion of starting up a church, because you have to take that context into account when you're in a place. And, you know, for somebody, as you said, from the South, let's say deep in Georgia, coming up here and saying they're going to set up a certain type of church, a lot of people are going to say, whoa, what is this all about? And likewise, if you head down to Georgia and are trying to set something up, it might not necessarily fit. So fitting the church to the area, fitting the church to what the demographic is, I think, is going to be an important consideration here. So let's go ahead and do that. Let's talk about how you started fitting a church together. And let's go back to day one. And I'm, again, we're talking here only about 9-10 days ago. Monday, September 26, 2011, you decide that you're going to create a new church in the town of Duval. So you get up Monday morning. What is your, what do you think? The first thing you get up, I mean, you make the toast and coffee, but then what?
Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, I think from minute one, the big thing was, man, I don't know if we fully know what we're doing, you know, and I know that's going to seem a little bit strange as it unpacks, it's going to seem like we did, but I think from the get-go, the team that I was working with, which was about six people, was the real core of that team. Six to seven people were the nucleus of getting things underway in 7 days. And none of us on that team had ever been a part of an endeavor like this aggressively. Probably the closest person that had been a part of something like this was me, and that was 20 years ago, and I was an intern in a church that started a church, right? I mean, there was just no hands-on experience that any of us had ever, you know, been a part of, right? So in some ways, you know, the launch of this was one part learning, one part organizing, and one part executing, but in rapid time, right? So the learning curve was steep, but the team, and this is probably always going to be the core of anything that really is going to get traction, the team that's launching it, it's not just an academic enterprise, and it's not just a task to be performed. I think the root of everything we were doing was very passionate, was very hungry, and was very positive. And I think that's the other thing. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning that it was part of this was born out of a schism, and yet for us, as we did this, there wasn't a licking of wounds, an anger in that, or anything. It was really like, we want to then go do what we're meant to do. And we're ready to do it, and we're excited to do it. So when we met together at 8:30 on Monday morning, you know, the first thing we took note of is, what do we have? And the answer is nothing. We didn't have $1. We didn't have a tax ID number. We didn't have a PO box. We didn't have a phone number. We didn't have a building to meet in. We didn't have a name. Nothing.
Except,
you know, we had a group of people that said, we want to do this. And so when we say it was from scratch, at least from an infrastructure perspective, it was from scratch. We didn't have a mission statement at that point. We didn't have bylaws. You know, we're still sketching the bylaws together as we speak. I mean, so in that sense, you know, the very first order of business was basically to say, we have nothing. All right. So now what do we need? And we spent the next hour just saying, okay, well, the first thing is establish a meeting space for Sunday, because we really wanted to be able to start that following Sunday.
That's what I wanted to ask about, because and I think that's important to recognize, because there was a certain exigency, a certain let's get things rolling. When you think about a startup for a business, you start putting together your business plan. You say, in 6 months, we're going to open this coffee shop here, and here's what we're doing. But you're talking getting up on Monday and say, this thing has to be operational in 6 days. Sunday morning is go time. So that must really have I think, put pressure on, put stress? I mean, was I
yeah, just, oh, mm-hmm. yeah, totally. I mean, you know, we joked all week that we were just operating off of caffeine and adrenaline. I mean, it was that simple for us. And I would say for the first 72 hours, nobody really slept. I mean, it was catnap stuff for people mm-hmm. in that first 72 hours because, you know, by 9:30 Monday morning, we had somewhat of a way forward, right? So each person on the team had different responsibilities. And, you know, because it's not as simple as, you know, like I think when somebody looks at how you start up a church rapidly like that, you know, one might look and go, okay, well, the most important thing is, you know, making sure you have a bank account, tax ID number, and a space, mm-hmm. right? But that's just one thing. And that wasn't necessarily even the primary. I mean, it was important, right, to be mm-hmm. able to do it by Sunday. But the other part was really to be able to articulate that week who we are, why we exist, what we're doing, and where we're going. We wanted to be able to come in on Sunday and say, you know, this is our name, this is our motto, this is our mission statement, mm-hmm. all of which we also did not have
right.
at 8:30 Monday morning. So we did, in other words, you know, you could like launch it like a rocket or be like a dog trying to catch a car, but once you catch it, you don't know what to do with it. And we didn't want that. We didn't want to say, hey, we all met on Sunday morning. Well, who are we? We don't know. What is our distinctive? Well, we don't know. Well, give us yeah. another week. We didn't want to do that. So that's where we had to kind of triple dip the whole endeavor, right? Which was the structure of it, the mission of it, and then the marketing mm-hmm. of it, right? All three things were in the water at the same time. And that's probably, I think that was kind of an audacious thing for us to try to accomplish in 7 days. But all three were really, really critical.
Let me go ahead and I think you make an important point there, and this realization that you have to have a mission statement first and foremost, because again, if you show up on Sunday and a lot of people are there and they're people in the audience are saying, okay, now what? And you say, well, we're not sure yet. Well, then next week, not so many people are going to be showing up.
Right.
So you have to have a pretty clear indication of what you're doing. So you're doing that, as you say, between 8:30 and 9:30. And again, we're taking this down to the micro details,
right.
almost to the
right.
minute here. And I just have a simple logistic question, because I'm being a sociologist of religion, a political scientist of religion, we oftentimes think about the big, huge issues. But I'm interested in some of the more micro mechanics of this. Where'd mm-hmm. you meet? Somebody's house?
Yeah.
A coffee shop? Where'd you do?
Yeah, it was really funny. The very first meeting was actually at the home of a gal named Lisa Bailey, who is great at infrastructure and just, you know, just a go-getter. And the main reason we met at her house is because she's blind and couldn't drive to a location. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're like, well, we're all going to Lisa's because that's what's going to work best for her, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, we just met in a living room, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of, like I said, took the quick inventory, said, you know, what do we need to have done by the end of Monday?
Right.
You know, I mean, we had the bigger picture, what we had to have done by the end of the week, but it really was, you know, let's put this in the order of priority.
Okay.
And that was that first hour, you know.
Okay. So let me, before we talk about that first hour and getting to your priorities on that first day, you mentioned we. Who's the we? I mean, you don't have
yeah.
to give specific names, but I mean, who's involved in this? It's you, Pastor Matt, and Lisa Bailey's house, and well, I just pulling random people off the street. Who are these folks?
No, this was all a team of people that I had been working with up to that point. And so it was two fellow pastors, Scott Thompson and Ryan Habig, that honestly, they've meant the world to me in this whole thing. I mean, this is so much an endeavor of that team. I mean, you know, I'm humbled by the whole thing, and especially working with those two particular guys pastorally has been huge for me. And so those two guys were part of it. Another guy named Shane Bailey, who is just a phenomenal, you know, guy as far as like he'll do anything that you need him to do, and he'll just rush to get it done. So he was a part of it. Another guy named Reese Venterton, who's another just real go-getter in that mix. And so and then another guy named Wes Felt, who is a recent intern to our environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really the collective group that said, all right, let's figure it all out. Let's put it all together, and let's start deploying everybody to different tasks in that.
Okay. So there's your group, about a half dozen folks. Hour one, figuring out all it has to come together. So the mission idea is the first thing, right?
Kind of. Really what we knew is that we had more time to work on mission. As far as we had, I mean, it's going to sound funny. We knew we had 5 days to work on mission,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Versus we had a lot less time to secure insurance, Okay. Right? 'Cause things that people don't think about, like, hey, we're going to rent a school on Sunday. Well, the school wants to make sure that your organization has insurance, or they're not letting you in the school on Sunday, right? So on Monday, it's like, well, what do we need? Well, we need a tax ID number if people are going to give contributions. Because, again, we didn't have a buck to our name at Monday morning at 8:30, and the school is going to cost you, you know, roughly about $1,000, you know, deposit and all the rental stuff, everything else, a little south of that, right? So, you know, we're like, okay, well, we need insurance, we need a tax ID number, we need a PO box that people can mail any giving to they want to, those kinds of things. And some of that is just the churning of the gears of the institutions that you're at the mercy of for that, right? Mm-hmm. So to get the school, for example, well, now you're dealing with, you know, a system that they, when we called them at 9:30, they said, well, it's going to take about 2 weeks.
Uh-oh.
You know what I mean? So we're like, oh, that's going to be interesting. Yeah. So that'll be a part of the story is probably, is we get to 10:30, right? So we're still just 8:30 to 9:30, right? Yeah. So, you know, but that's going to take you 2 weeks. You know, insurance, it's like, that's going to be really tight. Tax ID number, you're dealing with the government at that point. Nobody anticipates that's going to go quickly. You know, and so we had to kind of say, what are the things we have to have underway on Monday? Just matter of fact, if we're going to make it to Friday and it be done, right? So those technicalities were really top tier priorities to start executing that day. And the mission statement, we had time.
Now, Friday, you mentioned Friday as the date that has to be done. You're talking because a lot of these things are business week type of things, that the doors close of the government office, of the insurance office at Friday at 5 p.m., so this has to be done, right?
Precisely, okay. Right? And then, of course, in that too, then the school needs to make sure all of that, and they're going to be closed up shop on Friday. So, that, you know, they're not going to have the janitor come out on Sunday if there isn't the insurance. And so they wanted to know actually by Thursday that we had the insurance, which was another cool story because we didn't have it until Friday at 3. And this is going to come down to networking, you know, in a lot of ways too. That's the other part of this whole aspect is probably how you can network within a community as you're doing things like this, and how grassroots even that networking becomes. You know, a person who's a part of what you're doing knows a person who knows a person that helps speed that along. And some of that came into play too.
Yeah, that is one of the interesting things that I really appreciate, not only about the American religious landscape, but American life in general, is that there's an attitude in American life, and there's somewhat of a mythic quality to this, is the can-do spirit. And so having worked with the Boy Scouts, I know that the Boy Scouts have this type of mentality, is that, you know, if something needs to be done, we can go look for a specific one-shop stopping place that does that for you, but they don't exist. So you pull together a lot of people with different interests, with different skills, who are going to say, okay, I can do this. I know so-and-so who knows so-and-so at this place, and we can get that. I'll take care of that and move over. And so I guess that's what you're talking about here in terms of networking.
Yeah, oh, totally. It's absolutely that way.
Okay, so we're in there in first hour. You're setting up this priority. We need insurance. We need tax ID number. We need a place to meet. What are we going to do here? Take us through the next hour.
The next hour was kind of the huddle break, right? Okay. So we, by 9:30, said everybody knows what they need to start working on. And so, you know, some of the other things we didn't really so much talk about in that hour was getting a website.
Website, right?
So it goes back to your infrastructure, your marketing, and your mission statement, right? All three were in the water. And so we then said, okay, well, we need to have the part that we hope to go viral, right? Which is going to be leveraging, you know, Facebook and web presence. So then we knew we needed to populate it, right? You need content. That comes back to, you know, we knew we had some time, but if we wanted to get the message out by Tuesday, which was our target, we needed to really start writing content as far as who we were. And so, you know, I was kind of the team that was going to write content. Ryan Habig was the team that was going to create the online presence and infrastructure, and then Scott and the rest of the team were starting to work on the other elements of, you know, the actual structure itself, you know, and getting that kind of thing. So that's really what happened from 9:30 to 10:30 was everybody scattered into town to start working on their different things.
Okay, let's start talking about that. I want to get to the marketing a little bit later, the Facebook, getting the message out, so to speak. And let's go ahead and start with the place to meet, because a place to meet is rather important. And whereas a lot of religions talk about how they are present, ever present in the world and want to go out in the world, and that's one of the messages that your church has, is, but you still need a place to meet. Right. There has to be a central location so people know that you're there, they know there's a place to go to, they know that there's a sense of community. So you're thinking about, okay, where are we going to meet? Lisa Bailey's living room, probably a little bit too small.
Right.
Actually, let me ask you a question on this. Did you have an idea of how many people would show up on Sunday? Did you know if it might be 5, it might be 50,000? Did you have a sense for that? And did that affect your search for the space?
Kind of. I mean, in other words, you know, we had certain assumptions that, you know, we knew that there was a leadership core and their families were a part of it. So we could have said with some level of certainty, we know we have 20 families. You know, we could say that with certainty.
Right.
Beyond that, we had assumptions where we thought, well, maybe it would be, you know, 200. You know, we kind of guess factored that a little bit and said, okay, we could see that possibly because of relationships we have with other people and that kind of thing, and having a little bit of a sense of tone of things, it might be 200 people. And so with that, obviously, you're looking at spaces that are, you know, obviously the living room isn't going to do it, a local coffee shop isn't going to do it, and so a school became the primary focus. Because in that, you know, you're going to have a space where the adults are meeting, and you're going to have a space where the kids are having their stuff. And
yeah.
So we knew we needed something that could accomplish both of those goals, and so we just said, what are some of the area schools, whether elementary, junior high, or high school, what's out there? And then we kind of had a priority list because we looked and we said, well, you know, the high school would be the first best option because it's known, you know, its location's more known in our community than some of the other options. It's not quite as central as we would choose, but it has the kind of the vibe of being central. In other words, you know, it's not central to town, but people will think in terms of it's like a second center,
right?
You know what I mean, to the community. And so we wanted it really to be the high school. But if the other schools were going to be more accommodating to what we needed really rapidly, we would have used another school until we could get the high school.
Yeah, that's a good point that you make about the nature of the space, too, because you're thinking, well, we're starting a church, so we need one space. But that one space really includes two spaces for the kids' ministry, for the adult ministry. One could think about pushing the two together, and then all of a sudden you would think that a lot of parents with 5 or 6 year olds might not be coming that week because they don't know if there's a place they can keep their kid. You know, parents are always embarrassed if their kids cry out in church. We tell them, right, don't be, but you know, that's a consideration. So
Well, and even that evolved over probably a 4-hour cycle.
Okay.
So, you know, like from moment one, there was a certain level of get just one big room and we'll put everybody in it for the first Sunday. Because there was this, you know, it was so urgent to get it up. We planned that. We're like, it's just going to be men, women, children, everybody in one room. And then kind of by hour three, we said, well, let's try to pull off children's up to third grade.
Yeah.
And then by the next day, we said, oh, we think we could do this up to fifth grade. So, you know, it really evolved even over a 2-day cycle, how much diversity we would try to accomplish in that first week.
Okay, so you set up a list of places that you think would accommodate. And again, you're thinking on the fly here as you go along. Let's get four walls. But wait, we can get more separate rooms. How can we divide this? So you go out to the high school and you say, hi, guess what? We're forming a church. You doing anything on Sunday? I mean, what was that like to go and contact somebody like that?
Yeah, no, it was pretty much like that, right? So we contacted the district. The district said it's going to take 2 weeks. Of course, we're like, we don't have 2 weeks.
Yep.
Is there anybody we can talk to? And they said, well, you can talk to this person up at the high school. And they actually said, well, you can talk to this person at another junior high, or elementary school, rather. And so then we got on the horn to the elementary school, and they're like, you know, we think we could accommodate you by this Sunday. And we're like, sweet, you know, we got a space. Not our first choice, because this particular school kind of nestled out in the woods, a little off the beaten path. It would have been hard for people to find. And so we said, well, let's just wait, and let's see if the high school is going to be something that could work. And literally by 10:30, right? So now we're 2 hours into this endeavor. And by 10:30, one of the people within our team had gotten all the way through the channels into the high school and talked with a gal that said, you know what? We've been having a church that meets up here, but they just had their last Sunday here. And so we would love to have another church in the building. And the janitors would love that because the janitors, of course, you know, Washington State, they've recently taken a cut, right? Yeah. And so they're eager to help because they're going to make some extra money doing it. And so they said, yeah, we can totally do that. And we're like, can you do it by this Sunday? And they're like, yeah, we could probably swing that by this Sunday. And so, like I said, literally within 2 hours, we had the exact space we wanted. And they were ready to roll the following week, provided we had all the other paperwork in place to do that.
Okay, so that's very fortuitous in that regard. Now, one thing I want to ask about this, and this is somewhat surprising, and you may have given a bit of a hint of the answer already, but when you think about locating a church, public high school? I mean, public high school? You hear all the tension about between church and state and the wall of separation, yada, yada, yada. Would a public high school want to do that? Now, you mentioned that this high school had already had a church that was meeting in there. And then also, you indicated the fact that the janitors would love this because there's another couple hours of work, right? So there's a fiduciary concern or fiduciary factor that works into this whole equation. So
right.
What's your thoughts on public high school?
I think it's the best option. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of ways. I think it's cool for a number of reasons. I think one is sometimes, you know, and I come from the evangelical world, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes evangelicals overstate how much evangelicals aren't liked in the public forum. And I don't buy it. I mean, I'm more and more thinking that there are certainly pockets out there that may not like evangelicalism, may even have an agenda against evangelicalism. But when I look at the mainstream culture, I mean, the average Joe in America and the average Jane in America that are working in public high schools and working in businesses in a community or whatever, we find them to be much more willing to help and be accommodating and try to work it out. And that's what we found with the public high school. I mean, they weren't like, oh, I don't know, what are you guys going to talk about here? I mean, they were just like, great, we love to work that out. It gives them, some options financially for the janitorial team that's there. A lot of the people that are a part of local churches also volunteer at schools. They're teachers at schools. Right. They're administrators at schools. And so I think there's a lot more room for churches and state to work together more than not. Mm-hmm. And I just think sometimes it gets a little overblown, or there's just really loud voices on either side of that equation that kind of flip out. But when I'm watching the environment of even this church unfolding this week, you know, we had the public school that was more than accommodating. We had businesses in the community. You know, we were laughing about it, and we kind of posted it on some of our stuff this week. The first two businesses that let us post information about our church meeting on Sunday was the local tavern and the local pub. Mm-hmm. They were the very first businesses that said, yeah, put up a flyer for your church.
Yeah.
You know, they were very happy to do that, as were a lot of other businesses. So even where we're meeting now has become our offices for the last 2 weeks, and they've been phenomenal, right? So, you know.
Yeah, we should give another shout out to the Match Wine and Coffee Bar. And we should also note that we're drinking coffee here. it is a wine bar, but that's usually in the evening, and we're recording here in the morning. But, big shout out to them and to some of the businesses that you've had. It's interesting. You mentioned how, you know, the public high school is not a separate entity from the church. And I think that is really important to understand, that there are people in that high school who belong to the church, and there's the community is woven together in a lot of different ways that makes a lot of this stuff possible. And so, again, but, you know, you think a lot of people would be really shocked that a public high school would be doing this, but, you know, it seems to be a relatively common occurrence.
It's very popular, I think, nowadays in the United States. And I think it's a great example even of when you have local government and local organizations that are working together. You know what I mean? I think because you all live in the same, you know, kind of ecosystem, so to speak, socially,
right.
It just makes it go better. And I think people want to generally help other people in whatever the conditions are.
It definitely, the smaller town feel of Duval probably adds a lot to that. Mm-hmm. But even in large cities, you still have small communities, small neighborhoods, and small pockets. And I think you're also right, too, just to step back a minute, about the tension that the public sector has with the religious sector. We recently did a podcast with Brad Wright on Christian stereotypes, and that was one of the things, is the conclusion is that, you know, actually the population is pretty good with evangelical Christians. They really like us, so, you know, let's kind of move on and start building relationships, what you're doing here. Talking about building relationships, okay, so you get the high school, and they're saying, great, we have a spot here on Sunday, but you know, you just can't walk in. You got to have some other things here. One of the things that they mentioned is insurance.
Right.
And again, this is something that they probably don't teach you in divinity school.
They don't teach you any of this stuff.
Right? Yeah, which is kind of interesting, right? Say, well, you're going to go and preach, and here's how you, you know, what the book of Acts means, and, oh, if you want to talk about Job and the Old Testament, so this is what this means. Oh, by the way, you have to get insurance,
right?
Because if somebody walks through a plate glass window at the high school, well, that could cause lots of legal implications. So, you know, fortunately, somebody thought about that right up front and said, whoa, we need insurance. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, that was pretty much, you know, we looked, and it always goes back to, you know, everybody in a launch team like this or a planting team has a different set of skills, or at least if you're ever doing it, don't get five people that are all good at the same thing, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that was the other big thing for us. We just had a very diversified team. So, you know, at that point, we were able to look at part of the team that was going to be their skill set, and we're like, okay, go get on that. And so instantly, Reese Venterton was paperwork in hand. You know, this is what I need to get. Gets on the horn with an insurance company that she had worked with, to which he said, you know, that guy was like, hey, we want to help you, but it's going to have to go to an underwriter, and they're not even local. And she's like, well, hey, is there anything you can do? And she kind of just kept lovingly pressing back on, yeah. Is there something more immediate, more close, somebody you can directly work with? And so, you know, they worked really hard to find options that they could expedite everything. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the one thing that, you know, we were really prayerful on deep into Friday. I mean, Thursday into Friday, we're like, this is the thing that needs to come together, because that was the slowest moving thing of all. Mm-hmm. And the thing that had the most impact on whether we could do things on Sunday outside of a space, right? Space and insurance were the two biggest things to get underway by Sunday. And so, you know, she just stayed on it. I mean, literally multiple times a day, you know, each day. Mm-hmm. How's it going? Where's it at? Is there a way we can do it different? And even her involvement in that did help expedite it. He'd be like, oh, well, I remember this person. That's right. I can call them.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so kind of the get-to-itiveness that mm-hmm. she had was huge in the process. Because again, if it would have just been, well, I'll just let a guy figure it out and hopefully it works,
yeah.
we might have missed Sunday one, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
The sheet goes to the bottom of the pile with all these
exactly,
other policies
you know,
they're working
exactly,
on.
You know, because we're, I mean, it's going into any business and saying, hey, I need it now. Well, everybody says that,
yeah,
right? You know,
right.
And so we really did need it now, but we would have just been, we'd probably still be waiting around yeah. on Tuesday of this week going, okay, what's next?
Yeah, so. And then again, you know, as we're talking, there's a lot of people who are interested in making that move to the new church, and if it's not happening Sunday, you could possibly lose a lot of people.
Right,
so
right.
The you know, the rapid aspect of this, or the need to get everything moving, is quite important. Now, going back to the insurance question, is there a special religiously insurance or something? I mean,
No, not really. I mean, it's certainly you're going to have insurance in the nonprofit realm, right? So it's yeah. really more that. You're looking for that, and it's insurance that doesn't have a facility, but you're insuring the organization. And there's different layers to that. So even the insurance that we were able to land by Friday didn't have certain things that now we're going to come back around to this week. So we didn't have insurance for the officers. We didn't have insurance for, and this is an unfortunate reality within church dynamics, certainly as we see in the last few years, but insurance for any kind of child molestation, child abuse mm-hmm. issues, that kind of thing. That's more exhaustive because you have to go through background checks for the officers and things like that. The insurance company, they're like, there's no way we can do that in 5 days, but we can give you this insurance for this week, and then we can do those other things next week. And that was sufficient for the school. The school said, that insurance is good enough for us.
Okay.
Work
yeah.
on the next batch of your, or next layer of your insurance
right.
the following week, and you're good to go. And so that's the other thing, you know, you almost have to think about nowadays is churches are, you know, they're paddling upstream on a few issues mm-hmm. culturally. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so you have to really put those safeguards in place also. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have to have that week one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that kind of works out too. The other big thing that you needed was to have some kind of a legal status. And this becomes important because you're going to be passing the offering plate. As you mentioned, you know, 8:30 Monday morning, you don't have dollar one. You
right.
have nothing there. And, you know, churches can pray for manna from heaven, and that has worked in the past, but it doesn't always work. And God works in mysterious ways. So you are going to need to have some financial resources here. And one of the big issues with churches is their nonprofit status. You need to have some legal status that says we're a 501c3 type of organization. So you got to get that.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, you know, first hour, boom, we need the legal status in that regard. So we're going to go to the get our tax ID number at the government. How did you do that?
Right. So this was where it was really cool. Another person that was in our mix not as intensively this week was a gal named Sarah Gunderson, who is an accountant and has done a lot of accounting work for different corporations and nonprofits. And so here's another person with a working knowledge of things. And so she was able to roll in also in that initial meeting on Monday morning and say, here's, she had a binder. She'd printed off on Sunday night. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Here's what you need to know. Yeah. Here's what you can do this week as much as possible. Here's what you can do over the next 2 weeks. Here's what you do over the next 6 months, you know? And so, and each state is a little bit different, but in the state of Washington, there's certain flexibilities on that to where we could get a tax ID number. And since we're directly a church, the way Washington State has kind of set this up is because you're directly a church, as you start that, now you instantly have sort of this grace period of taking tax deductible donations. So you can get that underway rapidly as you're then applying and working for your full 501 status. And so 501 status gives us other protections in that. Mm-hmm. But as far as tax deductible donations, we could do it as soon as the tax ID number was in place. Mm-hmm. And so in our case, we did the paperwork and, you know, you had one of two options. You mail it down to Olympia and you wait a week and then you wait to hear back, or you can run it down and they'll do it that day. Well, we contacted them and said, well, could we fax it to you directly and you expedite it?
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, well, we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, and just so our listeners know, Olympia is the capital of the state of Washington. So all you fifth graders with your geography tests, if you're listening, you've picked up another fact that you can know. But Olympia is probably about an hour and a half drive from here. And that's assuming that there's pretty easygoing traffic. So, yeah, maybe you could have sent a runner down, but you're saying we got our launch team doing 15 other things, and that's maybe an hour and a half to 3 hours of time that we don't have. Plus, you might have to wait in line there. So can we fax it? That's what you're thinking, right?
Right, right. And yeah. Now we had a runner prepared because we didn't want to fiddle with it. You know, I mean, like, there's going to be any hiccups in this. We don't really have the time for the hiccups either. So we were prepared to do that, but we, you know, however that member of the team did it, was able to get right to somebody in Olympia and get it set up through mm-hmm. them directly. So again, now that wasn't a local channel, obviously. I mean, it's a somebody that doesn't know somebody, period. I mean, right. That's it. But we just happened to come across the right person that was willing to move fast and get it done for us and everything down there at the state capitol.
Well,
so
kudos to state government here in Washington, right? I mean, if and this is what I was thinking. When I heard that this church was starting up, I said, whoa, boy, getting a tax ID number, that's going to take a year and a half, right?
Right.
I literally thought that is going to be the slowest process of everything, but it appears of all the different bureaucratic hurdles, that seemed to be the lowest one you had to cross or jump.
Yeah, I mean, all the way around, you think about it. So the public school and the state tax ID number, mm-hmm. two of the faster things,
yeah.
Oddly enough. It was private sector insurance and things like that were the slower part. Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of it is the nature of the beast, too.
Right.
You know what I mean? In some ways, maybe, you know, oddly enough, the government side just didn't happen to be the beast this week.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that moved pretty swiftly for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, again, fascinating for me that you can move that fast. And with the insurance you're talking, you do got to get background checks. They got to figure out who you are. I guess one would have to figure out with the tax ID number, too, who you are. And I'm wondering how you negotiated that, because I'm almost wondering now that, well, I'm going to declare myself a tax-exempt status and I'm going to, you know, call myself the Church of Research on Religion and send down for one. I mean, were they asking questions about you, and what did you have to answer to them? What do you have to tell them?
You know, it's just pretty much a simple form that you fill out, and then you're just kind of making a declaration of, we're a church, this is our purpose and mission. You kind of check those boxes and that's it. It seems that the state of Washington, whether this is good or whether it's bad, is relatively flexible on that. Now, mm-hmm. of course, they can always come back and, like, we want proof, right?
Right.
I mean, oh, let me get this straight. So this is out of your basement, and
yeah,
there's two of you that make up the church, and, you know, that kind of, then you're going to have some trouble, you know what I mean? But, you know, it's those are things that are pretty easy to substantiate down the road if they come ask questions like, well, you know,
mm-hmm.
what is this church? What is it about? And this is where it comes into when you file bylaws and things like that, too. So not all of that you have to have in a day. But all of that is stuff that you have to build in, you know. And so this is where it was cool that you could launch certain things quickly, and then other things you can add into this equation later. And some of that even comes into when you file for the 501 and all of that. You know, you start to pack it in more. But as far as being able to at least rapidly start, it's a little bit like a rolling start in some ways. Mm-hmm. You know, we were able to get up to speed before the race even starts, and then you finally go into the green, right? So it's kind of like that in some ways.
Well, you mentioned the thing about bylaws now, and that triggered something in my brain here, too, that I hadn't really thought about, and it's probably a good thing that you were thinking about it because it's important for the church, is the bylaws is essentially a constitution for the church. And when I talk to my political science students, the constitution is basically a set of rules that tells you who gets to make other rules and how things are going to operate. Who's in charge of this? Who's in charge of that? It could be very hierarchical and authoritarian, or it could be very, you know, loose-knit, but it is still a document that says this is how things will operate. Did that come to you right away? Was that one of the first hour things, whoa, we need some bylaws? Or was it a Wednesday, hey, oh, by the way, we should figure out who's in charge?
Right. No, we knew instantly we needed that. Okay. We also knew instantly that we had a little bit of breathing room on that. Mm-hmm. Because what was important, we want everything to be intentional. You know, we didn't want everything to be reactionary. When you're launching a church in 7 days, there are just some things that are reactionary. There's no way around that.
And what do you mean by that? What do you mean by reaction?
Reaction is like, hey, we need a building. You know what I mean? Hey, we need the tax ID. Hey, we need a PO box. You know, those are things that are like you're just going to have to react to get those things done quickly. Other things, though, especially when you get into why we exist and how we're structured, we wanted that to be really intentional. In other words, we didn't want to just like slap together some bylaws or grab somebody else's and say, hey, we're just going to be this. Mm-hmm. We wanted it to be indigenous to who we were. And so that's where that's a little bit slower process. You know, the mission statement, kind of the identity, the campfire that we're all going to rally around, that came quick Monday night, really, and into Tuesday morning. But taking that stuff now, and we're like building that into the bylaws, which for us, the bylaws, the most important thing was that they would reflect who we really are, how we really see Jesus in the Bible, built into the bylaws, and that they would be slim more than they would be thick.
Okay.
And that was another thing, because a lot of the way we see the landscape going forward, for I think almost any church in the United States, is that it has to operate light and fast. You know, kind of, you know, we would probably say from experience that slow, bloated, lots of rules, lots of legislation, all of that kind of stuff will completely kill momentum. And so, you know, we intentionally said we're going to keep that as slim and light as possible for flexibility, as opposed to, you know, in other words, we don't want the bylaws to solve every potential future problem. We're not interested in that. You know what I mean?
It becomes too detailed. It becomes like the European Union's constitution, which is
useless.
You know, 20,000 pages or something, right? And then in constitutions that are usually pretty thin and flexible are usually the ones that work quite the best. So as of now, we're 9 days or so after church launch. Do you have those bylaws? Are they still in process, work in process, or where are you at after 9 days?
Yeah, they're still a work in process. Originally, we had hoped that we would have them done basically sometime early this week. But you know, one of the things that sort of the nature of launching a church like this also is, and this probably comes in part to the get the word out aspect, is we have, as a team, have also tried to be very much in the community the whole time, right? So down on Main Street, in the storefronts, you know, all that kind of thing. So we're talking with a lot of people. So in that sense, it's really good, because that's your mission. People are your mission in a lot of ways, right? So we're spending a lot of time with people. We're passing the word through a lot of people. People are like, hey, we heard about this, heard about that, you know, so it's all been really positive. But it also means you're not getting in front of the laptop, you know, and really being able to write that out and write it out as thoughtfully and as expediently as I would certainly like. So at this point, we'll be meeting next Monday as a leadership to talk about some of the things that are sort of getting unpacked in those bylaws. But I really don't even estimate they'll be done till probably maybe the middle of October. But again, it's because we're choosing a very thoughtful route. We want it to really reflect who we are, and not just, again, something you download off the internet and say, eh, close enough. That's good, you know.
Yeah. So there's certain things you can do on the fly very quickly, find the building, get the insurance stuff rolling. Other things you want to spend a little bit more thoughtful time in as you're setting up your structure, setting up your bylaws of how things are going to operate in the long run. We talked about, and you introduced this a little bit about, you're in the community, you're talking to people, you're getting the word out. So I want to talk about how to get the word out. But before that, there's one other thing that you have to have even before you get the word out, and that's a name. Right. I mean, you can't say, well, we're starting up this thingy, religious thingy.
Right.
Right. And somebody says, well, you know, we're doing this. Well, what's the name of your church? How can I locate you? And we don't oftentimes think that names are important, but names can have a great deal of importance. They signify certain types of information about the church, and it also gives you an identity in and of itself. So Monday, are you thinking about a name? Is it coming later? Are you putting names in a big, huge fishbowl and drawing them out? What are you doing?
Right. Now, that was the very first decision that was made, right?
Okay.
So, in other words, at 8:30, the question was asked, so who are we? And it was interesting because really did not land on the name until Sunday night, the night before. So, you know, I had an email into Scott.
So this is not the Sunday of the first services, but this is
a week before
the Monday. So this is not day one, but kind of day zero or day negative
exactly.
one, I guess, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Where, you know, I sent an email to the two of the key guys I was working with, Scott and Ryan, and I said, you know, we got to land on a name. And Scott said, I'll let you choose, you know? And I'm like, I don't know if I want that decision. and you know, and Ryan's like, you know, we'd kind of spun around different ideas. And actually, originally, we had a completely different name that we were tossing around. You know, if we were planning a church, what would we call it? And then as I started thinking about it more, I thought, I don't think that's reflective of probably what's most important to us. You know what I mean? Because you can look at a name either as what's the best marketable name, or you can look at a name from what's going to capture your identity. Mm-hmm. And it was important to me to say the name needs to be rooted more in our identity, what we're fighting for, what we would die for, what we would, you know, really give ourselves to. And so it was really with that late Sunday night when Scott said, hey, I'll let you choose, and Ryan's like, you know, I kind of like this one idea we kicked around, that I rolled in on Monday morning and said officially, for the first time, the church will be called Redemption Church.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to confess, you know, as I said that to the team, there was a certain level of nervousness even, you know, like, this is it. This is what we're going to call it. Because, you know, I've been in church for 20 years. Paint colors, carpet colors, and names, you know, those are the ones that, you know, get people all freaked out, and they want to, you know, whatever it is, up in arms, they don't like it. Everybody has an opinion.
Yeah.
And so there was a trepidation about it. And it was funny, even when I said we're going to be Redemption Church, the first noise in the room was, oh, that's interesting.
At that moment, did you say, uh-oh?
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, man. So instantly I said, well, let me explain why. You know what I mean? And it was really pretty fundamental to me. You know, one, it's theological. Second, it's missional. And third, it's hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it goes back to purpose again. And so it was like redemption says something about what Jesus did for us, right? Missional, it's a message that we want to bring to the world. And hopeful is because, again, God values you so much, he purchased, right? So, again, it wasn't just a, hey, what's going to be cool on a flyer? You know, in fact, if anything, we had to work through the fact that, well, does this sound too religious or does it sound too something else, you know? And in the end, we decided it was immaterial because what really mattered is it captured the identity of what mattered to us. Theology matters to us, mission matters to us, and hopefulness matters to us. So it was settled at that point.
It's really interesting, too, that we're talking about names, and oftentimes we tend to downplay the role of a name. We say, oh, names are just important. They're just labels or that. But again, this is the first thing that really kind of came to mind before that Monday morning where you start thinking about things. And as you're saying, it really conveys a purpose about the identity of the church. It has an importance to it. You're going through the thought process of, well, will this look splashy and fancy on a banner or a flyer that's going to go out? And, you know, one could almost imagine, well, let's pick a name that's going to attract people, like the, you know, the Church of the Comfy Beanbags and Free Coffee or something,
right?
Because I ask a little people, but again, you know, you the identity issue became very important. So, well, let the identity speak for itself.
So I guess
that's what you're saying there. So you got the name, Redemption Church. Do you want to say what some of the previous other names were or no? Do you want to keep that
on the list? You know, I mean, we went a lot around things that pertain to like real life, you know, kind of this, you know, like, you know, kind of having this thing that says, you know what, Jesus is about your daily affairs kind of thing. And he came to give you abundant life, real life. And we were, you know, kind of down that road for a long time. And part of that thinking was a little bit more like, well, a person that maybe doesn't do church, isn't interested in church, could they identify with that?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And we're like, yeah, well, they could identify with it. But we're really shifted there in that last 12 hours or whatever to a very non-popular name. I mean, was again, what captures more what is important to us. And not that life, real life, and abundant life aren't important things, but we're like, this other thing is definitely something we can rally around more because it captures the full body of what we care about in a single word, redemption. You know what I mean? And so that's where, at least for me, as the guy they looked at and said, you just choose finally. You know what I mean? Because, you know, we'd gone around, in, you know, like in previous conversation. And so it was like, all right, well, then I'll just call the ball on this one and take the hits if it's the worst thing ever chosen.
Well, interesting,
but it rolled pretty good.
Interestingly, from a sociological perspective, the term redemption, as you mentioned, as well, that has a really religiously, it sounds old religious, maybe, you know, it's got that fire and brimstone kind of feel to it, or maybe not fire and brimstone, but it definitely has a religious-y feel to it. But from the sociology of religion, a number of scholars have been finding that people really are rooted in religion, and that when you try to come out with watered-down names of we're the fluffy bunny slippers church, that people don't go for that. People are thirsty for more rigorous types of religion. They want to know what the message is, not the fuzzy edges of the message. They want to know what the message is. So, you know, who knows? We'll find out if that works or not. You got the name now. Now you got to get the word out. And this brings us to the issue, and we used this term earlier in the podcast, marketing. And I just recently had a brief exchange on Facebook with one of my Facebook friends, and actually one of my friends from a long time ago, thought it was kind of ironic to use the term marketing with religion, because marketing sounds, you know, Madison Avenue, that you're selling a candy bar and you got a glossy ad and the caramel is dripping down there and you're trying to, in many ways, deceive people coming in. I mean, that's the image that advertising has. But one of the cases that I made on this Facebook exchange, well, marketing is just getting the word about, because you can't just say, well, we're going to create a church, stand in the building that you found and hope everybody shows up. You got to get the word out. And in fact, you know, marketing might in many ways be about spreading the gospel. I know some people are going to react, and another pastor jumped in on the conversation and says, well, I don't know if that sounds quite right. And I go, well, you know, just think about what that is. You need to get the word out. You got something good that you want to bring to people, but that doesn't automatically happen. You got to go out and tell them. So in some way you have to market, or just another maybe softer word of saying it is get information about who you are, where you are, what you're about. So how do you do that? You got a week. This is not going to be, you know, advertising on Monday Night Football. What are you going
to
do here?
Right. Well, and there was kind of different layers to that we talked about rapidly again. Everything was very quick conversations, but I think we had a sense of like, okay, this is going to be our strategy for it. And so we knew there was fundamentally three arms to it. One was going to be web presence in a page that we control. Right. And so that was going to be, quote, the web page of the church. The second was going to be Facebook. And we used Facebook probably most successfully in this to A, drive people to the website, and B, because the infrastructure of Facebook is so designed to be viral. I mean, it's just absolutely designed to be viral. And so we talked about that. We're like, man, what we need to do is we need to carpet bomb our Facebook accounts with this and then encourage others to do that as well. But then we knew we needed some level of content to that. It couldn't just be like, hey, Redemption Church exists. You know, we're like, let's come up with very simple flyers. Let's come up with a few videos that we'll shoot in town off of iPhones. I mean, literally, this was so bubblegum and popsicle sticks. We weren't out there with a fancy camera and decent mics or anything. We just grabbed our iPhones and shot stuff out on the street or in front of my front door or whatever else. So we gave content that was brief content and easily transferable to another person's Facebook page, and you could spot it quick.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tapped into the viral nature of Facebook pretty heavily. But then the other thing is, as we did that and we created little flyers and little things, we really encourage people, hey, this is your job now too.
Mm-hmm.
You take this to the community. You ask restaurants or pubs or whatever else in town to put up the flyer. You share this with your friends. Call your sphere of influence. Email your sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. And so we knew that it had to be... We just basically did grassroots, leveraging a lot of technology. And then we just made sure every day to have something. And so like the first day, really, which was, I think, Monday night, I put something on Facebook that basically said, hey, here's where it's at right now. Mm-hmm. You know, here's the few things that are underway. We have a name, but we're not going to tell you.
Everybody's got to come back tomorrow.
Blank church, So blank church. But here's our basic statement. Yeah. You know what I mean? A group of imperfect people redeemed by a perfect God. You know, and so that captures who we are. You know, and so then people are like, "Ooh, there was a buzz." Well, then it was.
Well, I noticed that the word redeem was in there, so it's probably good that you didn't pick imperfect church. Although that kind of fits with the, you know, that would be a hard sell, I guess, right? But that is part of your mission statement, imperfect people redeemed by God, and you went with the redemption aspect.
Right. Yeah. So it was kind of a teaser in there, and then it was fun because there were certainly people within the core that knew we had chosen a name, and it was just a matter of time before somebody was going to be too excited and leak it, right? So that's exactly what happened on Monday night. It leaked out somebody not a part of the core. And so all of a sudden, I started getting emails that night. I heard it's called Redemption. I heard that's the name. Is that the name? You know? And that kind of thing. And so it was funny, the next day, the person that leaked it emailed me, and they're like, I'm really sorry. I didn't, you know. And I said, no, it was perfect. Yeah. Because in other words, we couldn't hold it back.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't buy that. You can't coach that. You can't even ask for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just like something where people were excited. And that leak was fun because then people were scanning through Facebook. Somebody leaked the name. Where's the name?
Mm-hmm.
So then on Tuesday morning when we said, hey, it's Redemption Church and here's the link and all of that, then it was just a flood of traffic. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally we launched the website Tuesday morning. I think Ryan put it up somewhere early morning. We publicized it then, I think, 8:30 Tuesday morning, and by 12:30 or 1 o'clock that day, we had over 1,000 hits on the website. By Friday, we had like 7,000 hits, and that's coupled to Facebook. So the viral nature, people excited, spreading it to their friends, saying here's what's going on, putting the content out there every day. So it wasn't just like we said it on Tuesday and then said nothing till Friday. We tried to make sure we were building content through the week to give them something every week to go to, look forward to, see what's going on, and for them to take ownership of it.
Right.
And so all of that was very intentional, not like we spent weeks thinking about it. Literally, we spent minutes coming up with that strategy. And it kind of even evolved as the week went on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There were some things were just serendipitous. You know, we were like, we should shoot a video and throw it up. What were we going to do? And I kind of mapped out, well, here's like 5 video ideas that we could do. You know what I mean? And we kind of landed on 2 of them for the week and kind of evolved it from there. I think the whole idea of a church without walls really evolved on Tuesday. I mean, this has become a central part now of how we're kind of defining our mission. That really wasn't so much the thought on Monday. It was like when it finally clicked as we were meeting in Match here, where we're meeting right now. We're like, hey, we're a church without walls now. Oh, hey, we're a church without walls.
Yeah.
You know, this is really kind of cool. This isn't a bad thing. This is an awesome thing. I mean, why wouldn't more people choose this? I mean, because that's what all churches say. We want to reach people. We want to care for our communities. But sometimes we huddle behind our own walls in our own churches. It's a little bit more the arrows all point toward our church. Hey, come check us out.
Yeah.
As opposed to how about we get out and check out the community.
Mm-hmm.
So it was right there. It was really obvious once that clicked. I mean, we're not that smart as a team, to be honest. I mean, you know, we're like, this is just one of those things where like we're just, again, flying on the adrenaline and caffeine and unpacking the problem as we're going.
But for me, this is a really interesting aspect of entrepreneurship in not only American business, but in American religion, because you might say, well, none of us are really smart individuals, but a lot of you have different pieces of the intelligence, right? And it's all coming together in a lot of different ways and in very unexpected ways. I'm a big fan of Friedrich Hayek, and he talks a lot about this emergent order, that nobody has the idea, but lots of people have little ideas, and then all comes together to make something bigger than what it is. The order kind of emerges from this, and you know, in a way too, like you're saying, on the fly. And this it's not somebody sitting down and saying, okay, here's our plan. We have it all written down perfectly. It's outlined, you know, Roman numeral 1A1, and we're going to follow that there. Is that, well, we kind of got this. We got some general ideas where we want to go, and everybody's adding something to the mix that comes in. And in many ways, I think that is really exciting. You can almost just get the visual impression of a bunch of people sitting in coffee houses here in Duval and just going down the main street. And for those of you who don't know, Duval pretty much only has one street, a few sides on it. But people just kind of spreading that word and people adding on to that in ways you'd never expect, very innovative. And
right.
I think in many ways is an analogy for all of American religious history, is that there's always been people coming in with, let's try it this way, let's do something different here, and nothing has been planned out, but it creates bigger things, newer things, which are kind of interesting. So
yeah, absolutely.
All right, so we're getting the word out, you're putting the message out, people got flyers, people are talking to people at the post office, they're talking to people in the coffee shops, all that kind of thing. Something else you're going to need along the way is stuff and junk, right? And now this right. This seems almost kind of an afterthought, but it's really important. You're going to need, well, you do music, right? So you're going to have the musician stuff, the chords and the amplifiers. And you know, a lot of people own that stuff who are doing the musical stuff. But also things like communion plates and offering baskets. So were you thinking about that right away? Or was it Saturday evening at midnight saying, whoa, we need an offering basket. Where are we going to get that?
Right, right. No, that was a part of that 8:30 to 9:30 meeting also.
Okay.
Where we said, all right, what are the things we need? Now, some things, it wasn't until Tuesday or Wednesday that we're like, oh, yeah, don't forget that too. Mm-hmm. But we knew we needed equipment, right, for all of the sound stuff. And we knew we needed things for, things you got to think about is, you need pack and plays because you're going to have babies that get dropped off in your pseudo nursery, which used to be the science room. You know what I mean? Every other day of the week. It's going to be the science room is going to be the nursery today. So we need pack and plays. We need carpets to lay down. We need toys for the little kids. We need all of those kinds of things. And so we started saying, all right, what do we need on that front? And then we thought, well, with our whole no dollars and no cents, how are we going to get any of that? And so actually by the end of meeting one, so by 9:30, we had $1,000 to our name. So that was pretty good, right? We went from zero to within an hour, we had $1,000. But we weren't going to use the money for that. That was going to be for the school. School's going to be about $1,000.
Right.
So we said, again, this is the viral ownership nature. Let's just put on the website when we get it up, here's the list of things we need. For all the adult stuff and all the kids stuff. We need pack and plays, we need toys, we need books, we need crayons and supplies and paper and the whole list there. We need coffee and coffee pots. We don't have coffee cups. We don't have sugar. We don't have anything.
Yeah, because in the Pacific Northwest, ain't nobody coming to church without a coffee
pot. It's sort of mandatory,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Jesus, the Bible, and coffee, some caffeine, right? So it's just an absolute need, right? So we just said, we're going to put the list out there and we're going to see if people jump on that list, right? We'll just do it that way. And that's just going to be the way it works. So I think we probably had the list up by Wednesday. The other part of that list was, hey, man, we need people to haul the stuff in, set the stuff up. We've never done this before. Day one, we're going to roll in at 8 and try to fire up by 10 on a Sunday morning. So we need a lot of volunteers and we need a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's the labor. I mean, one time or oftentimes we forget about that. It's not only just the stuff, but it's the people to move the stuff to where it's supposed to be. So that volunteer aspect, the volunteer labor is going to be incredibly important.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And so all of that was, we kind of compiled a list of that stuff and put it on the site. And I think by Friday, everything was filled.
Mm-hmm.
So, we had a list of, I don't know, maybe 40 or 50 items or something like that. And a lot of that was people going out and buying it even. They're like, we're going to buy it, give it to you as a gift. That kind of thing. So there was, there was a little bit of kind of the hand-me-down thing, but for the most part, people even appreciated that we needed dependable items. We needed to know it wasn't like a pack and play for a little baby that maybe had a broken leg. I mean, they were thoughtful about that. And so that whole list was totally achieved by Friday. The big ticket items were things like video projection unit, sound equipment, things that were like, You know, that's not just donated typically, but we had people that said, hey, I've got a sound system. Hey, I've got equipment. Hey, I have a little production studio in my home, and you can totally use that equipment. I will totally, you know, throw that in the mix. And so, again, it was just people with buy-in that said, we want to contribute. We want to help. We want to do all of that. And so all of that list stuff and all of the volunteerism packed in. I mean, literally, when we were setting up on Sunday, I think we had somewhere between – I think I've heard between like 50 and 70 people who showed up to set up and help and, you know, make it all work. And it was just a crazy madhouse of putting it all together since, again, we had 2 hours and never done it before. We just didn't know what we didn't know.
Well, one of the things you mentioned prior to this podcast was that not only did people volunteer things and stuff and buy things for you, but you got some assistance from other churches, didn't you?
Yeah, and that was the other thing. So like the communion and all of that, it was cool because you know, we're like, how we had one way we were going to do communion. We realized the configuration of the room wasn't going to allow us to do it. I mean, it's weird things that you have to. We literally had drawn out the auditorium we'd meet in. We'd be like, okay, well, the people could do this. They could funnel through this way. And we were like trying to just figure this out.
Micro
and then
details.
We're like, well, that won't work. You know, that's going to be just crazy, you know? And, you know, what happens if somebody doesn't want to take communion? Well, they're going to have to go all the way through the process anyway just to get to the communion table and be like, no, thanks. You know what I mean? I'm not a Christian. I shouldn't be doing this or whatever, right? So we're like, no, we need to pass the plates. But, you know, to get enough trays, for it's not cheap. I mean, each one of those communion trays, things that people don't realize, they're about $70 to $80 per tray.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have, you know, the money to buy 3, 4, 5 trays, whatever it might be, right? So we then got on the horn with churches in town. In fact, you know, early on, I got on the horn with them, you know, and just like, hey, we're starting a church, here's what's going on. And they totally rallied behind what we were doing. And so, you know, one of the churches in town here, Valley Foursquare, they gave us a bunch of communion trays to use this week. There was another church in Snohomish. I got a buddy of mine up there, and he's like, hey, man, I've got about 100 little holes, you know, in one of these trays that you could use. And so they did that. Adventure Church here in town, they're like, hey, if you need a midweek space for your women's ministry, we can totally make that available. So this goes back to this whole weird blend between competition and helping one another at the same time. I mean, that's just true to churches. I mean, you know, because they all want Jesus to win. They want the gospel to win. They want the kingdom to advance. And yet, we also serve each other. And so they were huge in that process of those little details that we just didn't have the money to roll out on. And we don't even know how we're going to do it next time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the stopgap, they stepped right up for us.
That's one thing I want to mention briefly, and moving into a little bit more sociological direction here, is that I have written a great deal about religious competition and have gone on the conference circuit and the lecture circuit talking about this. And I think there's a big misunderstanding about what that really means. And the story that you're telling here is really fills in what I've always thought about competition, that it's not a negative sum game. To some extent, there is that every congregant I get into my building on Sunday is one less that you have. But, you know, there's enough unchurched people in this area that we can, you know, still be pulling that. But the other part of competition is that it makes you work harder, makes you better, and makes you smarter by looking what other people are doing. And not only that, there's a sense of this positive sum aspect to it, that we're all in this together, and my business or my church is going to help your church be stronger, and your church is going to help my church be stronger. And I think we oftentimes forget that when we use that word competition, which tends to have that my football team wins and yours doesn't aspect to it.
Yeah, I think part of that even is, like, you know, if you used an analogy, I think I look at pastors that have this healthy sense of competition a little bit like I watch snowboarders or I watch guys in the X Games. Those guys are all competing against each other, and they're high-fiving each other every time a dude outdoes them.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? And I think it's that spirit. I think if you get an insecure pastor, he doesn't love that game so much, right? Because of his insecurities. But I think if you get secure guys, they'll be like, oh, dude, that was off the chain what you did. And it's a high five because Jesus is winning, the gospel is winning, and you dig that. And it makes you want to be a little bit better at what you do, how you do it, how you communicate, how you think through things, that kind of deal. So, you know, I look at the guys in this town who, all of them, I really respect. And I think they're like a bunch of snowboarders. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, man, that was huge, man, what you did, you know? So I think that's the good competition that goes on.
So let me, and we're running a little bit over time here, but this is such a great conversation. I'm going to keep it going, and I hope that our listeners bear with us. You can listen to this in chunks if you want. But I want to take us up now to Sunday. So you got the insurance, you got the building, you know, the insurance comes in at the very last possible minute, you got your name, word is getting out here. Sunday morning, you already talked about getting, you have 2 hours to set up, 50 to 70 people are showing up to fold chairs, to put in, you know, the crayons for the kids in a certain area, to put down the chords for all the musicians and all that kind of stuff that goes together. And again, it's a lot of stuff we don't think about when we're building a church, but it's those little details that go, which way are we going to direct communion? I mean, it doesn't, well, that's just a silly, irrelevant thing. No, it's actually a big deal, right? Because as you say, if you direct somebody to communion who doesn't want to take communion, you could possibly lose that person forever, right? Do you force them into a situation you want? So it's Sunday now. It's Sunday, and you don't know, you think you got at least 20 core people that are coming, a dozen or so families. How many people show up?
Final count for Sunday, like men, women, and children, was 562.
Wow. Now, put that in perspective here, because the average church, and we heard this on a recent podcast with Mark Davis, was the average church is about 70 to 80 people in the United States. Now, there's big mega churches, and so that, you know, the modal, I should say, is about 70 people. So 500 and what?
62.
562, yeah. Almost 600.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
What's the capacity of the auditorium you were in?
The auditorium seating-wise was about 330.
Ooh.
Yeah. And
okay.
Then we had people standing along the walls, put chairs in the back.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, just it was slammed. It was totally slammed.
Did that astound you? Did you expect 560 something?
No. I mean, I can honestly say, you know, people are like, come on. And I'm like, no. I mean, honestly, and part of my problem sometimes, it's funny to have, you know, you listen to everything we've done this week and people might think like, well, you're a pretty optimistic guy. No, I'm pretty much a pessimistic guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I honestly thought, boy, if we have 200, that'll be great. And especially on Monday when it all started, that number was even lower for me. The startup, I mean, you know, it was fatiguing and stuff like that. I'm like, 150 people, 200, that's a win. I'm going to call that a huge win if that's the case. When it started going viral was when we started going, well, maybe there'll be more than what we anticipated. You know, so Monday morning, we knew we had about 20 core families, probably a part of it, thinking maybe as many as 150 to 200. By Wednesday or Thursday, as viral as we were watching it, we're like, well, maybe it's going to be more than that. Maybe it's, you know, maybe 300, you know what I mean? And because we just didn't know. Because you don't know what people are really going to do. Just because it's viral doesn't mean they're going to show up to it. Mm-hmm. Just because there's buzz, you don't know. And so when I went up simply to instruct that, hey, there's like three seats down here and there's five seats over there or whatever. And that's when it really hit me that this is a lot more people we would have anticipated.
Well, who were those people? Again, we go back to the opening. We talked that this is somewhat of a schismatic movement. That's, are these the people that you saw previously, or did you see a bunch of new faces?
It was both. I mean, there was a lot of new faces. There was a lot of people where I'm like, I don't know who that person is. I've never seen that person before. Mm-hmm. There was clusters of people where I'm like, that's just not a familiar face to me. So, you know, and even, I couldn't even tell you how to backtrack that right now. I knew of people that said, hey, we invited our friends because, and that goes back to the viral nature of it because it was so high energy because people were excited because people had a sense of personal buy-in. You had so many people throwing themselves behind it, not just saying, hey, those five people are creating a church.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's almost like this, when I talk about the team effort was so much broader than that group on Monday. It's just a kind of, you know, the sphere of influence and decision-making and responsibility transfers as it goes out from that center.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people had personally gotten behind this at some level that then, as it moved forward more, they wanted to bring friends. They wanted to kind of say, here's what I was a part of this week. And so I think that's where there was a lot of it, too, is just people brought people.
Yeah.
You know, people heard of it somehow and news got out.
Now, a lot of excitement going on there, a lot of energy. And, you know, for myself personally, hearing about this, as a social scientist, I'm like, wow, this is a really cool opportunity for me, too. So you look at a number of different sides as a practicing Christian, but as a social scientist. So really exciting. There's a lot of excitement here. Now, we're getting near the end of our podcast. We haven't talked about some other things, such as the small groups, or as you called them, the regroups, the kids ministry or the junior high ministry and the high school ministry. We'll probably have a podcast in the future with your youth minister, Scott Thompson, and probably your music minister, Ryan Habig. So we'll leave that for another day. But I want to kind of close out church on Sunday, 560-some people sitting there, a lot of energy, a lot of new faces. How do you keep that enthusiasm going? What's the next step? What does week two and the next 3 or 4 weeks look like for you?
Yeah, the next 2 weeks, we're keeping it all as one service. I mean, there was talk pretty instantly of, you know, you got people standing along the walls, and if we're going to continue to fulfill our mission and try to reach more people, there's just no capacity to do it. Mm-hmm. But we said for the next couple of weeks, we need to keep it at one service. We need to keep them all together and continue to transfer the identity to the people at large, right? So this Sunday was part of that transfer. The next 2 Sundays will continue to be the transfer of this is what Redemption Church is about. This is what it does, how it does it. A little bit more mechanics to that even as far as how to be in our community, a church without walls, what that looks like. So that'll be the next 2 weeks. And then after that, you know, we'll look at the transition into 2 services. And even that is a whole thing in and of itself to go, you know, you got this big glob of people, and as soon as you go to 2, are you going to have where it's 50 people go to 1 and everybody else goes to the other, and then so 1 feels desolate and what happened to all the energy suddenly? Mm-hmm. So even those little simple things we have to stop and think through, like how do you equally divide it into 2 services, and how do you encourage people to think in terms of even a servant's in a service. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to serve the second service by going to it because there's less people there. I mean, it's that kind of stuff that we want to think through and coach along as we go. So for the Sunday mornings, keeping it together for a couple of weeks, imparting the rest of the vision, and then from there, coaching people to think in terms of servants, even as they're sitting there. I'm still a servant, even as I'm sitting and listening. So that part of it. And then the other part, which is even for me tonight, is meeting with all of the regroup leaders. So everything from men's, women's, home groups, you know, college age groups, whatever, all these leaders, which again, it's phenomenal to see how many people are like, I want to do something now that have not done that before. And so meeting with a large group, because, you know, what we're saying is we group on Sunday and then we regroup in other environments in the week, because you have to stay tethered because there is no ranch anymore. Yeah. You know what I mean? We're you know, I joked with an email to our leadership today. I said, we're riding the open range now. I mean, this is long days and you're saddle sore, man. I mean, that's
right.
What it's going to be.
Yeah.
We don't have a ranch where we're all just comfortably on the ranch and, you know, everything is in a pen and it's easy.
And that really is interesting. And first of all, I think the term regroup is really interesting. There's been a lot of talk in recent decade or so about small groups and how small groups actually help big churches feel much smaller. But you're using the term regroup. Now, did you get that term from somewhere else, or was that your
idea?
No,
that was just born Thursday.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So, and that's a neat area because, again, you group on Sunday, but then after 10:30 or 11, everybody scatters. But then come Wednesday night, it's time to regroup. So I think that is a brilliant name to be talking about in and of itself. The other thing that's interesting about this church is that when you think about your traditional church, that church building is always there on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And so if people want to go there for a meeting or something, that you know where that is, right? But now on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that's the public high school. That's not Redemption Church.
Right.
And so it does create that interesting dilemma, which possibly could be a positive dynamic of regrouping in different pods or different areas around the town, which that's kind of interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that dilemma or perhaps that opportunity is really negotiated over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and it's both those things, right? It is a dilemma and it is an opportunity. And one of the things we're going to build into it that's maybe a little bit different than others who have focused on this is obviously some things are going to be in homes and that kind of thing, and we're going to be cool with that. But we're going to really encourage people to be embedded into the community with some of those groups. So, you know, if you can get seven chairs here at Match, or you can get a booth over at the Tap Room, or you can get a little section over at Ixtapa Mexican Restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, because we've kind of rolled this out as a church without walls. We're saying we don't want to just be a ministry to the city. We want to, you know, be in the city, and we want to depend on the city as we bless the city. And so we're going to really encourage people to be in the community as regroups, and not just in their homes as regroups. So both will exist, right? Because that goes back to kind of this missional philosophy we have as a church, which is really being in the community for the community to bless the city. Mm-hmm. And so a little bit different, because we're splitting the difference. We want fellowship, in essence, mm-hmm. and we want outreach at the same time. So we're blending ideas together and not just making them mutually exclusive. This thing is an outreach thing. This thing is an inreach thing. We're saying inreach can be outreach mm-hmm. simultaneously. And so this is going to be that philosophy that gets built in tonight with mm-hmm. our groups, to be like, think about this more and kind of make the paradigm shift to this more, so that we're really taking ownership of this whole idea of, mm-hmm. you know, what we say the gospel is about, mm-hmm. right? Not just saying it, but really doing it in a creative way.
Well, you it's definitely a work in progress. You're doing some new things tonight and meeting here tonight. So we're kind of here at the end of our podcast, and we still have so much more to talk about. So I think, would it be okay if we check in a couple months to see what has been happening? I think it'd be kind of interesting to track this as it goes along.
I think I'll be fascinated to be able to reflect on it after a couple of months and going, what just happened?
Yeah, that's part of it. So, well, anyways, again, we will link to the church website, the Facebook page, and as a way for our listeners to kind of check in if you're interested in this process. And remember as well, we have our own Facebook page. We have a comment site. So please feel free to chip in, to sign up on our Facebook page for regular insights. And Matt, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.